I tend to think that the Walmart-Humana deal, should it come to pass, is way bigger than what Amazon's talking about. They're far more influential in terms of a self-insured employer, and their reach is just staggering.
I'm Dan Diamond. This is Pulse Check, and that was John Gorman, this week's guest on how he sees the health insurance market. John's the head of the Gorman Health Group. He consults for private insurers. And one way to understand our healthcare system is to think about the incentives that drive decisions, whether patients seek care or insurance companies hunt for mergers, and who stands to gain or lose. On today's show, John sizes up how those incentives have changed, or not, under the Trump administration. And if you listen to our podcast with Matt Iles, the new leader of America's health insurance plans, this episode will be a good counterpart. Just a reminder that if you like Pulse Check, you can help us keep it going. Rate it, review it, share it with a friend. Just search on your favorite podcast app for Politico Pulse Check. And email me, I'm at ddiamond@politico.com, with suggestions or tips on who you would like to hear from next. And with that, here's my conversation with John Gorman. You worked in government. Now you've got your own shop,
yes,
the titularly named Gorman Health Group. When did you decide to make that move?
22 years ago next week. I was on the last few days of my first appointment with the Clinton administration. At the time, I was helping to run what was then the Office of Managed Care at what was then HCFA, which is now, of course, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And I was not a great fit in the government. I felt really constrained there. I enjoyed the experience, but I just didn't want to extend. And I felt like I had seen a lot in our work at the agency in understanding where the health plans that contracted with Medicare and Medicaid were struggling, and that we had some ideas about how we could help them be better business partners for the government. And so I had 15 grand in the bank, and I figured, I'll go give it a shot. If it doesn't work, I'll just tell everybody I went backpacking in Europe. And and on our second day out, I was finalizing our business plan, and I got a hit in the Wall Street Journal on some regulation that was coming out, and the phone started ringing and never stopped.
That was 22 years ago. So
yeah.
How old were you, if you don't mind my asking?
I was 27.
There are many people I talk to, either in the Humphrey Building around town, who have made that leap in their head, but have never actually gone through with leaving government work. What is the secret? When did you feel like you had the juice, the desire, the skill set to leave government service?
I mean, I think I had developed a reputation when I was at the agency as a guy who got stuff done. And I felt like we had a pretty good read on where the plans were struggling in doing business with the government. I mean, you got to remember, at this time, what's today Medicare Advantage was then the old Medicare risk program that sprung out of TEFRA 82. And there were barely 3 million people enrolled in the program, and it was like this novelty.
I want to just clarify for listeners who might not know that jargon, Medicare Advantage is the Medicare program that private insurers
exactly
can offer. So if a customer wants to get United Healthcare to provide, or Humana is mm-hmm. the biggest player in the Medicare Advantage space, it's a way of melding the private and public programs.
Exactly. And, it's always enjoyed bipartisan support, never been greater than it is today, actually. But if you had told me 22 years ago that today we would be sitting at 35% of the program enrolled in these health plans that contract with Medicare, I would have told you were smoking something excluded from Part D coverage.
Why do we have more than one third of Medicare beneficiaries in this program? Is it because as Americans have aged in, they were so familiar with private insurance that they opted for those programs? Is it because companies like Humana and others have been so aggressive at going after that market? Some combination?
All the above. What you're seeing right now is a real demographic driver in that the baby boomers who are retiring at and becoming Medicare eligible at a rate of $11,000 per day, 50% of them are choosing Medicare Advantage within their first 2 years of eligibility, because over 90% of them had an HMO or a PPO when they were working, and they're perfectly content continuing that relationship into their retirement. The program gives value-added services and protection from out-of-pocket costs that you don't see in traditional Medicare. There's an annual cap on out-of-pocket spending. You get all kinds of additional bells and whistles like gym memberships or vision or hearing benefits. And I think there are just a growing number of seniors that really like the idea that their care is going to be coordinated and not just this willy-nilly care that you see in traditional Medicare.
For a private insurance company in 2018, where is the bulk of the growth right now? How much is Medicare Advantage versus the rest of the market?
Medicare Advantage, really, especially for the big publicly traded companies like Humana and United, keeps the lights on for these guys now. And it has really become the greatest source of their both revenue and earnings. They're seeing a lot of commercial membership decline in recent years, largely because so many large employers are now not offering health insurance to their workers any longer. Medicaid is a huge line of business, but Medicare has really come to become a bedrock revenue item for most of these companies, and it's very steady, it's very predictable, and generally this is a pretty sticky population, so that when they enroll in a plan, they tend not to disenroll at rates that you see in the commercial world. So it has really become really the sole source of organic growth for most payers today.
It feels like this point is forgotten in much of the popular press. There is so much focus on the ACA market, the Affordable Care Act market that is politically fought over. And yet, compared to a market like Medicare, it's significantly less profitable and not as big.
Yeah. And, you know, most of the enrollment through the Affordable Care Act came through the Medicaid expansion. And we'll talk about that, I'm sure. But that was, you know, roughly 20 million people as opposed to the 11 or 12 million that enrolled through the exchanges. And it's become such a political hot potato that I think large companies like Anthem and United have pulled out of it. There's been very little controversy in Medicare Advantage or the Medicare risk program in its many, many years. We have to remember that this was a program that originated in the tax bill that Reagan passed in 82, and it has matured since. But, I think for most of these large payers, it's a very different line of business, and that Medicare is the most heavily regulated product line that an insurance company could possibly offer. And so the entry costs can be significant, but once you're in it and you get a base of enrollment, you have to remember that the payments that they get monthly from Medicare are roughly six times what they get paid in the commercial sector.
Medicare Advantage had been targeted too in the ACA run-up. President Obama had talked about maybe this program where we're subsidizing private health insurers isn't as good as the government health program. That gap should be closed. Instead, Medicare Advantage has only gone up since.
Exactly.
Looking at the state of health insurers in 2018, President Donald Trump has taken his shots at the industry and said that companies are failing in the ACA marketplace. But the most recent earnings reports have been incredibly positive. What is the truth, John? How are health insurers doing in the healthcare system right now?
I think great. I mean, when you look at their investment record on Wall Street, I mean, these guys are darlings. You see companies like United that are, United is now over a $200 billion company. It's now serving something on the magnitude of 115 million people. And it's largely used the Medicare program as the bedrock of its revenue and earnings.
Is that a good thing for United Healthcare to be that large?
Obviously, it's working for them.
Is it working for us as patients?
I think most United members are pretty happy. The company's star ratings, which is the performance measurement system that the Medicare program uses to assess quality and value, their ratings have consistently gone up. They have an acquisition track record that's unmatched in the entire sector. And I think they would say that it is a fixture in their participation in government programs. I mean, remember, they're in just about every government program that there is. They're in Medicaid, they're in the VA, they're in TRICARE. But Medicare, I think, has always been the most consistent line of business for them.
There was a great story in Bloomberg a few weeks ago by Zach Tracer. Mm-hmm. We'll link to it in the show notes. Mm-hmm. On the rise of United Health and their doctor army. You were quoted in that story. You told Zach, quote, "We're in an arms race with hospital systems." And you're talking about insurance companies.
Yeah.
Quote, "The goal is to better control the means of production in their key markets." Why is it a good thing for insurance companies to own doctor groups?
Well, when they own a doctor group, now instead of just having a contract with them, now if they own it, it now becomes an investment vehicle. And you can get the doctors in that practice to begin to practice medicine the way that you need them to. I mean, it's not dissimilar from the reason why Kaiser Permanente has opened its own med school, in that they want these docs to be able to practice the way that they need them to. I mean, let's recall that just a couple of years ago, United nuked its entire provider network nationally. I mean, in one day, they fired all 22,000 of their doctors in the state of Connecticut, for one. And largely that was done to ensure that they would be able to match these providers' performance against the STARS system better. And, you know, doctors really only respond to this kind of stuff when they have a gun to their head.
And just to de-jargon that for a second.
Yes.
So when you say they wanted to match their performance to the STAR ratings better, what do you mean?
Well, the STAR rating system is a roughly 50 measures performance-based payment system. It is literally the biggest experiment in performance-based payment on the planet right now. And those measures are very aggressive, and the bar keeps rising every year. And only when you really own physicians can you really have any hope of getting them to perform better against these many measures. So, you know, right now in STAR ratings, roughly half the score is determined by the member experience or the experience that the patient has going through the healthcare system. And you know, when you consider that STAR ratings and the member experience in particular is really driven not by the health plan staff, which only touches the beneficiary 8 to 10 times a year on average, but those beneficiaries have 26 encounters in the outpatient setting every year. So right out of the gate, their doctors are 2 to 3 times as influential on those performance measures as the plan itself is. Then it really makes sense to own these practices, and not to be lost on the fact that if a hospital system buys that practice, they're now charging Medicare 2 to 3 times as much as a hospital-based provider. So that's why I said it was an arms race, because there is very much a race going on, certainly in the case of United and its Optum subsidiary, which has been buying up doctors' groups like it's going out of style. It really is designed to control the means of production and to get these guys to practice the way you need them to. It's no accident that the highest performing plans under the STAR ratings system are Kaiser Permanente, who own all of their providers in what we call a staff model.
For decades and decades,
yes.
That's been their model.
Exactly.
It's been interesting to watch because there has been a trend time and again that doctors' groups need to be part of some bigger system. Hospitals bought them up 30 years ago. That experiment largely failed. The hospitals sold them off at big losses, and now we're buying them up again. Insurance companies are buying them up. The idea of a standalone doctor's office is dying out in America. But I think the flip side of this, John, you talked about the way to get the most production out of these groups. I think there are a lot of patients who worry that if an insurance company owns a doctor's group, that maybe the patient's outcomes aren't necessarily the most important metric. It's getting as many dollars out of that doctor, which doesn't always line up with access to crucial services.
Sure. Well, it's important to note that, you know, today most doctors, especially young ones that are coming out of med school and residency, really do dramatically prefer a salary than to be in private practice and taking some risk on your business.
I just want to underline that point, that young doctors would rather not have the calls at all hours of night. They want the predictability of being on a salary.
Exactly. And the low risk, which I get when you're coming out of med school, $250,000 in debt. From the payer standpoint, you know, again, this is it becomes a vehicle for investment where they can now sink huge dollars into additional staff or better facilities and better, you know, throughput of these patients so that their experience is better. I get some of the concern, but man, when you look at the track record of big medical groups that have historically been aligned with providers like Vanguard up in Boston or Adventist down in Florida or Advocate in Chicago, they do a damn good job. And it's because their goals are now aligned with that of the payer. And if you're a member of that payer, then that's probably a really good place to be.
United has grown in so many different directions, including buying up these physician groups. It hasn't been one of the insurers that attempted to mega merge. There was a series of these mega mergers killed by the government.
Right.
But Humana, Anthem, Aetna, they had all shopped around with each other. Now we're moving into a new stage of mergers potentially. CVS, the pharmacy company, and Aetna are looking to get together. Where do you see that trend going as someone who consults for the industry?
I mean, I see a lot of vertical integration deals working through the system now or being considered, as opposed to the horizontally arranged deals of last year and the year before that got shot down. I think these horizontally aligned deals are much harder to pass antitrust muster just because, you know, when you look at an Aetna and a Humana, they're obviously going to have huge overlapping markets where they really do exert some monopoly or oligopoly kind of anti-competitive behaviors. So the likelihood of those deals passing through the Justice Department's antitrust division were very low, as opposed to these deals that we're seeing now, like CVS Aetna, that are vertically aligned in of two different industries altogether, but that they're are still very complementary. I mean, man, when you look at the retail presence, the geography, the real estate that CVS owns and overlay that with Aetna's service areas, it's staggering how well they fit. And, you know, again, back to the star ratings point, you know, for Aetna, this is a critical deal because seniors go to retail pharmacies even more than they go to their doctor or get contacted by their own staff. So Aetna's awakened to the fact that, you know, retail pharmacy settings may be their best emerging friend. And to own or be merged with those locations and all of these capabilities that they either offer today or will soon, like in-store clinics, we're going to start to see these retail pharmacies as big hubs for telehealth, for medication therapy management visits and medication consults and stuff. You know, it's a very powerful asset to be part of. You know, in many of the neighborhoods where Aetna has enrollees, especially in inner cities or in rural areas where the beneficiaries are particularly tough to reach, the retail presence of some of these stores is just staggering and enables them, again, to invest in a real presence in those communities.
I've been covering this space in different ways for over a decade. I've heard again and again the idea that a retail clinic, either in a CVS pharmacy or in a Walmart, that one of these big box stores can go that extra mile. But for the most part, those retail clinics have washed out. Walmart has gone back and forth over how much they care about that market. But it sounds like you think that we are now at a moment where retail pharmacies are going to be significantly different and value add enough that this market is going to get bigger.
I do. Certainly for Walmart, I think one of the big considerations for them has been that their customers are falling off some. And by turning themselves into a healthcare hub, with most of them already have a pharmacy in store, now if this deal goes through with Humana, you know, they're massive investment in Conviva, this clinic division that they've got going. Now you can have a primary care clinic in there next to the pharmacy. Maybe they'll have even like a durable medical equipment shop or diabetic supplies in store. Now it becomes a hub for folks across the Walmart spectrum of markets to really be the one place you go to, the one-stop shop for all your healthcare needs.
And to just pull out something that you slipped in there, Walmart is talking with Humana,
yes,
the health insurer, about a merger there. So similar in that we have CVS and Aetna on one hand, and Walmart and Humana, untraditional partners, but maybe pushed this direction for different reasons. And I think one of the looming specters is actually Amazon. If Walmart shoppers have gone down because you don't need to go into that store, well, maybe healthcare will be that lure, even as Amazon itself is considering healthcare plays.
I tend to think that the Walmart-Humana deal, should it come to pass, is way bigger than what Amazon's talking about. I mean, for one thing, Humana and Walmart have three times the employees that Amazon, J.P. Morgan, and Berkshire Hathaway do.
That trio that is putting together their healthcare startup. Yeah.
And so they're far more influential in terms of a self-insured employer, and their reach is just staggering. Then you want to consider the fact that Walmart Humana is the only one of these deals under consideration that has a long track record. Walmart and Humana have been working together since the inception of the Medicare Part D drug benefit. And it's been a phenomenally successful partnership. I mean, ever since 2008, when it really got going, Humana has converted somewhere between 100,000 and 175,000 of its prescription drug-only plan members into its Medicare Advantage products, because Humana embeds its sales reps inside Walmart stores. They get all the foot traffic, which is, you know, predominantly older Americans these days. And it's been just a tremendously successful venture for the two of them.
And even if Walmart and Humana don't merge, there's a thought that they might just come out of this with a more enhanced relationship, which is still beneficial.
Exactly. And even further investment in the relationship in these geographic locations where Walmart is. I mean, remember, Walmart's whole footprint spans the Rust Belt and the Sun Belt, which is where Medicare Advantage has exploded since the drug benefit launched in 2006.
These big deals have gotten considerable attention. The Trump administration's moves against the Affordable Care Act also get a lot of virtual ink. But the Trump administration also just does the business of government. There are annual rules and regs that come out. Mm-hmm. There were some that came out just a few weeks ago with big implications for the insurance market. How is the Trump administration doing in terms of serving insurers? Did they do well, the insurers, did they do well in this recent reg package?
They did. I mean, when you look at this administration, though, it really is much a tale of two cities. You know, Medicare Advantage is the most beloved program on both sides of the aisle these days. But the Trump administration has absolutely, definitively declared war on Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act. So on the one hand, you know, they're showing great deference to a program for seniors who typically vote more regularly and have certainly for this president, and then actively sabotaging the Affordable Care Act, which, you know, is obviously Obama's big legacy that Trump is anxious to erase, and Medicaid, which is, you know, the program for poor folks, and that has become a real lightning rod among conservatives, especially in 32 or the 31 red states where they are really starting to advance some pretty mean spirited policies around Medicaid.
And the short-term plan idea that the Trump administration is proposing, that has insurers incredibly worried. The idea that there will be these alternates to the ACA, comprehensive plans that customers will sign up for instead.
So they've advanced this whole idea of these short-term plans, what most folks and regulators in this business call junk insurance, because, you know, they cover far, far less than the standardized policies that were created by the Affordable Care Act. Now, granted, if you're going to exempt maternity coverage or hospital services or drugs, then obviously those policies are going to be much cheaper. But I think most of our clients are running like scalded dogs from the idea of participating in this junk insurance market, because nobody really wants to go back to the days previous to the Affordable Care Act where insurers could legally discriminate against people based on health status or redline certain populations with product designs that, you know, something like this would, like these short-term policies really can do. They could just basically say we're not going to cover oncology services and therefore redline cancer patients out of those policies. So I think everybody in the industry really likes the level playing field that was created by the regulatory structure of the Affordable Care Act. And now in Trump's just obsession with erasing Obama's legacy, undermining these marketplaces with these junk insurance policies has everybody on pins and needles right now.
So that's why you think the short-term plan idea has been pushed, because it's an attempt to undermine the ACA?
Sure.
Or is it? I mean, there's an alternate way of looking at it, which is the president campaigned on giving people more choices and cheaper insurance.
Yep.
And these plans are going to be cheaper, at least up front, because they're not as comprehensive. You're getting less.
Exactly. But I think in his zeal to avoid anything that smacks of Obamaism in healthcare, you know, offering junk insurance policies that don't cover everything really puts the onus on the consumer to ensure that they're not getting screwed in these deals. And I would posit that most consumers are not actually prepared to make those decisions on an informed basis. You know, they will just buy a policy on the basis of the premium, and then they find out in a real moment of clarity that, oh my God, hospital services aren't covered by this policy that I bought. No wonder it was so much cheaper than the old Obamacare.
We had Matt Iles, the incoming head of America's health insurance plans. He's essentially America's top health insurance lobbyist, on this podcast a few weeks ago, and I was asking him about his perspective of this administration and his top priorities. And one of them was correcting the misinformation about health insurers in this administration. You work with many of the same folks who are members of AHIP. Mm-hmm. What is the biggest priority that insurers are seeking in Trump's Washington?
Well, they have a laundry list of things that they would really like to get done during this administration. And, you know, I think a lot of it is to maintain a very favorable posture around Medicare Advantage. Like I said, it keeps the lights on for these guys. It's the only source of real organic growth that they're seeing in year two of Trump. And, you know, so I think keeping a very favorable environment around Medicare is one. I think many of them would like to see this war against Medicaid come to an abrupt close, because Medicaid is also a
growth opportunity,
you know, a huge growth opportunity for so many of these payers. And I think a lot of them would like to see him back off of this posture that he's taken on Obamacare. I mean, I think most insurers really felt like at the end of the day, Obamacare was good for business. And having a level playing field from a regulatory standpoint on how their products were regulated was a big positive. So I think they're probably going to win out on item number one in Medicare Advantage, and they're losing on Medicaid and Obamacare.
One last question about Medicare Advantage, the new supplementals.
Yes.
That is something that,
huge,
in your view, has big potential to change this marketplace.
Yeah. This was a big policy change, and I think the biggest one that we've seen in at least a decade, where it's now going to allow the plans that participate in Medicare Advantage to include in their annual bid to Medicare items and services that would extend the ability of a beneficiary to stay in her home and that would reduce the burden of diseases and their unnecessary utilization of hospital and other healthcare services. What this really enables the plans to do now is to put in their bid a whole new toolbox of stuff that can address what we call social determinants of health. And these are things like income, where you live, your general health literacy, whether or not you have food security, access to care and providers in your community, and allows them to now start to put into their benefit designs and get Medicare to pay most of the costs for things that would address it. So, for instance, it now would enable plans to put in their bids all kinds of assistive devices in the home for folks with disabilities or who are fall risks. So, you know, ramps, bumpers, you know, railings, things of that sort. It enables plans to begin to offer telehealth services in ways that they never have been able to. It's going to enable plans to offer a food security benefit, or say Meals on Wheels will deliver you 90 days of three meals a day after you've been discharged from a hospital, because it's been proven that if these beneficiaries, especially those who are low income, have a food benefit, now they're not making decisions between food and medicine, and they're better, they're more compliant patients, they adhere better to their drug regimens, and they have a much lower readmission rate. So we're going to see some really new looks to some of these benefit designs. You're going to see things like anti-loneliness initiatives. I mean, this has become really big among some of the payers. Like CareMore in California has been working on this for years, where, you know, just by getting isolated seniors into contact with their peers and with others on a more regular basis, you reduce the incidence of depression. And we know that depression is a magnifier of healthcare costs, especially those with chronic disease.
I saw CareMore CEO Sachin Jain just writing about that this past weekend. John Gorman from the Gorman Health Group, thank you so much for joining Politico Pulse Check.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me.
That's it for Pulse Check this week. My thanks to Dave Shaw and Mikaela Rodriguez for producing the show, and John Gorman for joining me in studio. If you like Pulse Check, you can help us, rate us, review us, share it with a friend. Find me at ddiamond@politico.com with suggestions on who you'd like to hear from next. And we'll be back with a new episode of Pulse Check in your podcast player next week.